From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Nearly 3 million children in the U.S. are said to have a serious emotional or behavioral health condition. And for many of these kids and their families, the pandemic has ended treatments on which they depended. As a result, some have spiraled into emergency rooms and even police custody. Joining us today to talk more about what experts are calling a mental health epidemic is Illinois Public Media's health reporter, Christine Herman. Christine, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brian.
Co-reporting the piece and also joining us is NPR education reporter, Corey Turner. Corey, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And finally, we're also joined by Regina Kreider, Executive Director of Illinois Youth and Family Peer Support Alliance in Rantoul. Regina, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Because we taped this conversation ahead of time, listeners, we are not taking calls in this segment, but we do appreciate hearing what you thought about the show. You can always send us an email. The address is talk@21stshow.org. Listeners, we also want to make sure we're going to be talking about some sensitive subjects today. If you need to talk to someone, you know, we want to make sure you know who to call. If you or a loved one is experiencing suicidal thoughts and need help, please call the National Suicide Hotline. The number is 800-273-8255. Again, that's 800-273-8255. Or, of course, in case of an emergency, call 911. Corey, I want to begin with you. And let's start with a definition. Can you walk us through what it means when people say there is a mental health epidemic?
Yeah, sure. So going back to what you said in the intro there, Brian, we're talking about nearly 3 million kids in the U.S. with a serious mental health condition. Now, that's a big tent. It includes things like anxiety, depression, ADHD, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder. It can include or manifest as suicidal ideation. And you got to keep in mind, for these kids, the pandemic has made things worse in a handful of ways. So first of all, it triggered a shutdown of many in-person therapies that they were getting through their doctor's offices. And that's for the kids who are actually receiving care, who have a diagnosis, who were receiving some sort of therapy. But we also know a lot of kids, the main delivery system for their treatment is often through school. And we also know that at least for last spring, most schools closed for several months. And that also ended up shutting down at least the in-person therapies that these kids were getting, physical therapy, occupational therapy. And it's just been a challenge. And I think the last thing you've got to keep in mind too, insofar as schools are concerned as well, is like at schools, these kids are often surrounded by adults who are trained to understand what these kids are experiencing, what they're going through. And so it's not only that they were losing out on half an hour or an hour of therapy a week, but they're also losing access to these grownups in many ways. And their home where they're really left with their parents or their caregivers who may not be as experienced.
Yeah, not as equipped to handle what they're being confronted with. Maybe they were used to dealing with it for a certain period of time every day. Now they're dealing with it all day, every day, week after week.
Yeah.
Christine, let's talk about one of the families that you spoke with. Who is Sandra and her daughter, Lindsay?
Yeah, Brian. So Sandra and Lindsay live in Georgia. Sandra's a single mom. And Lindsay was 17 when the pandemic hit. She has autism. She really thrives on routine. And she loved going to school. And Sandra told us that they've had a long struggle with finding adequate support and treatment for Lindsay. But then the pandemic forcing schools closed was particularly hard for her daughter. They started dealing with really difficult behaviors. So as an example, she would still wake up at the same time, get ready for school, maybe waiting for a bus that wasn't going to come. But then she would just leave home and just walk, and sending Sandra into a panic.
It was bad. It's like her brain was wired. It's like she's ready to go. She just put her jacket and her coat and she's out the door, and I'm chasing her. So it's like when she's out there, I'm out there too, in the car, calling the cops. She's turning this way. She's turning this way, you know? And they said, ma'am, stay in one spot. But I can't, because if I stay in one spot, she's gone. I don't know where my daughter is, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the past year has obviously been hard for so many families, but when you have a child with special needs or with a mental health condition, it's just it's like next level difficult. The past year has been incredibly hard for Sandra and for their family. Lindsay has been hospitalized several times. There have been times she's ended up in police custody, which Corey and I explain in the story that we did for NPR. And Sandra has tried so many things, as I mentioned, to try to help her daughter. One example, the state has a mental health crisis line. People are told to call them first to get help. But she says it's really frustrating because she'll often get put on hold for 45 minutes. And when you're in the middle of a crisis, that's not very helpful.
Regina, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Is this a familiar story? Are you hearing from parents who are struggling to get help for their children?
Yeah, it actually is. We live in a rural community, and when families go into crisis, because a lot of times people think it's just the youth, but if the youth goes in crisis, the entire family is in crisis. But our system here in our community, the response time when you call for support is, they'll tell you it's going to be 2 hours minimally before they can actually attend to your particular situation. So absolutely, we are seeing the same things in our community.
We asked our Text the 21st group about this topic, and we got a number of responses. Katie in Springfield wrote in to say, I know mental illness is a serious concern for everyone throughout this pandemic, and I am concerned that it highlights our complete lack of comprehensive care for mental illness as a system. But, Katie adds, a loud contingent in the kids are suffering mental illness from not being in person in schools is coming from parents who are suffering mentally from having them at home. Regina, I wonder if you hear this kind of thing from parents who reach out to your organization for help. Is one of the big problems here that parents are under a lot of strain having kids at home with them that they're not used to having at home?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what can compound the problem with that scenario is that you can have more than one child at home who has a mental health condition. So if you're not accustomed to handling all of them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that increases parental stress. And that can then lodge a parent into their own mental health that can be caused just because of the situation. Or it could be something that you were already struggling with before you got, we went into the pandemic. Parental stress plays a really big part in helping our children to handle their mental health. And if parents aren't equipped to be able to do that, to be able to take care of themselves, it's a little bit more difficult for them to do it with their children because they're not getting an opportunity to refuel, to be able to do those things that are helpful for them in managing their own stress. So absolutely, those calls are coming in.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about the mental health epidemic and particularly how it's affected children across the country. And here in Illinois, we're speaking with Illinois Public Media reporter Christine Herman, NPR education reporter Corey Turner, and the executive director of the Illinois Youth and Family Peer Support Alliance, Regina Kreider. Corey and Christine, in your reporting, you both found that for some parents, even when they have the means to pay for help for their kids, they're still not able to receive it sometimes because of the inaccessibility of care. One of the parents you spoke with shared this idea. Let's listen to what she said.
I mean, even when you have the money or you have the insurance, it is still a travesty you cannot get help for these kids. And even beyond the telehealth, just the isolation of the kids not being in school, the lack of social interaction, that further isolates, and then that anger is taken out on the immediate people within the household. So just that in and of itself exacerbates the situation.
Christine, what's going on here? Why is there this gap, even for people who can afford to get care?
Yeah, Brian, it really goes back for years, even before the pandemic hit. There is a shortage of mental health providers, in particular people who are trained to work with children. So if you are in a community where you don't have a strong mental health system for children, if there just aren't the providers available, it doesn't matter what insurance you have. You might call around, you know, then of course there's issues with who's in network, who's out of network, if you have Medicaid versus private insurance. And then even if you have money and can pay, some parents we talked to said, we'll call the providers, but they have a 6-month wait list. My child needs treatment now or yesterday. So the concern is that the pandemic took a bad situation and has made it even worse, and that there's going to be really a great need for rebuilding a much stronger system going forward, because all of this mental health toll that we're talking about that the pandemic has taken on these kids and their families, it's not just going to go away once the pandemic's over. So there really needs to be more investment in a greater provider network. And overall, just, you know, there's the issue of stigma and the difficulty it is to talk about these things, and just making sure that kids have what they need when they need it. That's what a lot of mental health advocates are saying needs to be part of the conversation going forward here.
And Brian, I'd like to add a thought here too.
Please.
Because I feel like one of the things that I want to make clear here is, you know, we're not just talking about kids and families who had a diagnosis before the pandemic, who are in worst case situations. One of the things I've seen as a national education reporter time and time and time again is this pandemic has created an enormous amount of stress on many households with or without a history of any sort of mental illness. And we know, especially for kids, when they see their parents experiencing food insecurity, housing insecurity, job insecurity, plus if they see their parents coping with that stress through alcohol or drugs, these create trauma for kids. They're what we would call adverse childhood experiences. And this in and of itself can trigger a crisis for a child who may have had no other background. Like, I think we are going to see a long tail here from this pandemic because of the economic stress and the household stress it has created for kids who might not have even been on the radar for the healthcare workers in their schools or their pediatricians.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Corey, because it strikes me that when I was reading the introduction, I said nearly 3 million children in the U.S. are said to have a serious emotional or behavioral health condition. It sounds like what you're saying is that's maybe a floor, and that number is probably going up as we speak, as we continue to live through this crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, we really have to grapple with, you know, this is something I've been thinking about as a reporter right now, as the Congress considers creating a child allowance for families. This is a very real conversation right now. And it really stems from what has become increasingly clear and powerful data on the pervasive negative impact of poverty on kids. And not just, you know, it makes them uncomfortable. It stunts brain development. It creates stress, and stress changes the way our brains are wired, which all plays into mental health. And so we really have to make sure we don't separate the sort of economic crisis of this pandemic from the mental health crisis, especially when we're talking about kids, especially when we know it's low-income communities and communities of color that are being hit hardest by this pandemic.
And we need to take a break here in about a minute or two. But before we do, I want to leave people with something they can do if they're in this situation. And Regina, I want to ask you, are there organizations you'd recommend, aside, of course, from your own Illinois Youth and Family Peer Support Alliance, but that families can reach out to that offer support when they have kids with mental health issues?
So there are organizations that specialize in helping and assisting families with youth with mental health conditions. But there's also, those are those traditional services, such as, you know, your pediatrician, going to a therapist. You know, there's just a variety of very clinical challenge, you know, areas that families can participate in and access services. But a lot of times people don't think about the more broader services that are available. And one of the challenges in the mental health system for children has been the lack of services, like was mentioned before. But there are other interventions that work as well, and such as equine therapy, music classes, those things can work as well. And there are professionals who are working in those arenas that specialize with kids who have mental health conditions. And so I think it's important to think more broadly of what can be therapeutic for young people. Yeah, I think that there's a lot that doesn't go into that. And as Christine mentioned, and I'll just say it this way, the children's mental health system was broken before we got to this place. Mm-hmm. And we need to look at more diverse ways, because every child does not respond to therapy. Every child does not respond to, you know, taking medication. There needs to be some additional ways to meet the needs of families. And you can do that through by going to a Boys and Girls Club. A lot of those institutions are beginning to focus on children's mental health as well.
We are going to continue talking about what needs to be done and what people can do individually and what we need to do collectively to address this problem. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about what has been called an epidemic in mental health among children in the U.S., not just from the pandemic, but the pandemic has exacerbated the situation, as we're hearing, as a lot of people are not able to access the care that they counted on to help their children in crisis. We're talking with Illinois Public Media's health reporter Christine Herman, NPR education reporter Corey Turner, and Regina Kreider, who is executive director of the Illinois Youth and Family Peer Support Alliance in Rantoul. Corey, I want to come back to you. We're going to talk in a little bit about what sort of big picture things we need to do to address this, but what are the consequences? We've been talking about this lack of access to care, but what happens then when kids are in crisis and they're not getting this care?
I mean, I think the challenge is to go back to something Regina said. Our system was long broken before the pandemic. And so what we're seeing now is essentially a safety net behind the safety net that wasn't working very well. And by that, I just mean the folks who are on these calls now, who are often the front line, the first responders, are police and emergency rooms. And even emergency rooms are often not ideal because they don't have a lot of experience in pediatric mental health. Police especially, as we heard in the story about Sandra and her daughter that Christine and I reported, you know, you can only expect so much expertise from police when it comes to dealing with kids in mental health crisis. And throughout our reporting, you know, we interviewed a lot of families who all told us, look, we've dealt with the police many, many times. And it just depends on where they are. Sometimes the police are caring, they understand, they're responsive. And at other times, you get the opposite. That's just not a system that can work in the long run. And, you know, the schools now are an open question. Ideally, we'll see schools start opening up. But also, again, as an education reporter, I think it's really we expect so much of our schools already. I think we have to limit our expectations of what schools can do on this front.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, so much gets put on education as the be-all end-all to cure social ills in our country.
Yeah, it's just not fair.
Right. Christine, you've done some reporting on particularly how this is affecting hospitals, seeing this increase in mental health emergency visits among children.
Yeah. I mean, we think about being in a pandemic, we think about hospitals treating COVID patients. Of course, they're treating COVID patients, but they're also seeing an increase in the proportion of mental health emergency visits for children that's shown in the CDC data for kids ages 5 through 17. So I reached out to Colleen Cicchetti. She leads the Center for Childhood Resilience at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. And I shared this reporting that Corey and I did with her and asked if Lurie Children's was seeing the same thing that was happening nationally with other hospitals. Here's what she told me.
A lot of kids are showing up at our emergency room for mental health issues. You know, we have a long wait list for outpatient services. And we're also seeing a lot of these kids who they used to be able to get some of their additional mental health needs and their physical therapy or even their all of these different services through schools. As those services have been harder to access, we're seeing those kinds of complex cases showing up. And I worry that as this pandemic continues and things are disrupted and families are experiencing stress, that we're going to see more and more of that.
Regina, I want to ask you, when the doctor says to a parent, your child needs this, but then the parent goes out and tries to find that resource and can't find it, what is that like?
It's very frustrating because when a doctor makes a recommendation, we are looking for the system to support us, to feel like our kids are moving in the right direction and we are making the right decisions and moving in the right direction for our children as well. So it can be very disappointing. And it can also make parents want to give up just depending on how severe the behaviors are or how severe the crisis are that's happening. So that's why through our organization, we provide a lot of support around systems, navigations, making sure that we overturn every stone, but most importantly, realizing that we can't depend on doctors or nurses or systems to be able to answer and resolve all of our situations and issues.
Corey, I want to take a step back now. You've talked to some experts about, you know, things that need to be changed sort of on a, I was going to use the word global, but, you know, a big picture basis. Yeah. What needs to happen? Is it likely to happen? Maybe that's a separate question.
You know, I think this was the biggest takeaway for me in all of this reporting is just how flawed our mental health system is as a country, and also state by state by state. You know, the fact that really until recently in many places it was fairly common for parents to have to choose between surrendering custody of their kids to get the care they need and not having access to that care. You know, the system just doesn't work, and it doesn't work in so many ways. The one thing I heard that Christine and I heard from lots of experts was that first and foremost, we need a lot more pediatric psychiatrists. There is a chronic shortage and always has been. And what that, it just creates a real bottleneck in terms of services. And it often means that families can only access those expert services if they can pay for them out of pocket, which obviously creates an imbalanced system and then pushes those problems up through every other level of the system.
Doesn't sound like there are any quick fixes here, right? This is something that, I mean, we're talking about systemic change to the entire healthcare system.
I will say, just because I always try to be glass half full when I can.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear it.
Even though I have told you already, Brian, that I don't think it's fair to expect schools to fix everything that is broken in all of our systems, I will say that one of the many things that President Biden has included in his relief bill is more money. Last I checked, more money to add school counselors and mental health workers in schools, you know, which right now in lots of places is really more a symptom of the financial health of the school district than it is of whether or not they think it's important to have a qualified counselor, social worker, or, you know, behavioral health worker. So hopefully schools will be seeing more money to help cover those budget lines, that can only help kids.
You know, Corey, I wonder if this adds up to an argument for reopening schools. I mean, every time we talk about this on the program, we get feedback, do you want to kill teachers? Is that what's going on here? You don't care about the teacher's health, but I mean, we're talking about these very severe consequences for children. Is this an argument for reopening schools as soon as it's safe to do so, and maybe even when it's not quite perfectly 100% safe to do so?
Yeah, I mean, I have been at the center of those arguments as well, Brian, and you know, I take teacher and student health very seriously, and I tend to follow the science, and most folks have been arguing, most public health folks have been arguing that the decision to reopen schools should really be a local choice, based on what the pandemic is doing in your area. I will say, though, you know, I've been doing stories since April, last April, about the consequences of closed schools for kids. And everyone I have spoken to, whether they are in the mental health world, whether they're educators, they have all described to me the decision to reopen really as a scales. And if you're not thinking about it as a scales with consequences either way, then I think you're thinking about it in the wrong way. You know, reopening schools certainly poses risks, but we also have to remember that so does keeping them closed. I'm not saying one is right, the other is wrong. We have to remember that both decisions come with consequences.
Regina, last question to you. Taking a step back, what is the one thing you want people to leave this conversation with? What do you want people to understand about this issue?
I want people to understand that it's a complex issue and it's not going to be resolved overnight. I want people to understand that parents are doing the best that they can with what they have access to. I want people to understand that there are things that the community can do to wrap around and support families during this time, especially not being judgmental, but looking at ways of how they might be supportive. And also I want to leave a takeaway is, once again, like what's been said, schools cannot carry this all by themselves. And a lot of people don't realize that families who are navigating systems for their children can often have adversarial relationships with the schools. And so there has to be different ways of being able to support kids at school, but also in the community. And last but not least, I do agree that there is very huge shortage of psychiatric doctors, but we can also look at alternatives like a psychiatric nurse, which is a lot more easy to access, at least in my community it is. And I have found them to be just as effective. So those are the takeaways I would like to express.
Regina Kreider is the executive director of Illinois Youth and Family Peer Support Alliance in Rantoul. Regina, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st. And I also want to thank Corey Turner and Christine Herman. Corey Turner is the NPR education reporter. Christine is a health reporter at Illinois Public Media. Corey, Christine, thank you for your reporting and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Listeners, I want to mention one last time, if you need to talk to someone, we want to make sure you know who to call. If you or a loved one are experiencing suicidal thoughts and need help, you can call the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255.